Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming to this afternoon's great debate. And I promise you this one will be at least as lively, if not even more so, than what you've already seen from Paul Krugman and Stephen Moore. So thanks again for coming, and thank you to Mark Skousen and to Freedom Fest for organizing this exemplary event. I am Daniel McCarthy, editor of the American Conservative magazine, of which you have a copy in your packets. And I'll be moderating today's discussion between Angela Keaton and Ian Morris. Before we get started, we want to take a quick vote to see who agrees with the statement that war is good for absolutely nothing. Just raise your hand. Okay, so I think the deck is sort of stacked against Ian Morris here, but that's okay. He's a classicist, so he knows of many great stories of Spartans and others who have faced odds, if anything, even more daunting. By the way, while I do certainly suggest that you turn off your phone or at least silence it, if you are looking at your phone during the session, be sure that you are tweeting and texting out using the hashtag FreedomFest whether or not you agree with the statement that war is good for absolutely nothing. We'll be taking another vote at the end of the debate to see whose mind has been changed by what they've heard. So now I'm going to introduce to you our two very distinguished speakers for today. First, there is Angela Keaton, who is a longtime activist in the liberty movement. In fact, she was born into it, and she'll often ask you if you are a cradle libertarian or not. She currently serves as director of operations at antiwar.com, in which capacity she does many things, including overseeing the website's communications and much of its fundraising and other work. And if you like Indiana Jones, you are going to love Ian Morris, because he is the real thing. He is the Jean and Rebecca Willard Professor of Classics at Stanford University's Archaeology Center. He's the author of many thought-provoking and brilliant books, including Why the Rest Rules for Now, and the subject of today's panel, War, What Is It Good For?, about which he also has an op-ed in the New York Times, International New York Times, this morning. So without any further ado, I will give you Angela Keaton to speak on why war is good for absolutely nothing.
Oh, thank you to Mr. and Mrs. Skousen for having me here, and thank you to Professor Morris for agreeing to do this debate. Professor Morris noted in one of his talks that usually the first person who thinks of an idea is perceived as crazy. Well, I just want to assure you, all my ideas are plagiarized. I've spent the past several months reading War, What Is It Good For? And many great libertarian and conservative thinkers of our time. And I want to apologize to Dan and most of our audience, but war is good for some things. In fact, I'd say it's good for quite a few many things. First, war grows the state. It creates a big state. Big state. And second, but more importantly, wars have undermined the values normal Americans hold dear. And, you know, the theme of today, you know, theme of Freedom Fest is the new American dream, and I want to keep within that. War has been good for promoting American values, if you mean that to be a legacy of internment camps, price controls, and your children being conscripted to fight wars in faraway places to be returned with shell shock, missing limbs, body bags. All of which, by the way, benefits people from whoever benefits from media blackouts and sexual humiliation at airports. War demeans the Western and civilized traditions through which the military way of life is which is what undermines so much of the values many people here, many of whom are conservatives, claim dear. It's subsidized by taxation, which is a polite word for theft. It's a polite word for socialist redistribution of wealth. It's a way of life cheered on by those in the government schools and those who claim to be godly, which includes adultery, illegitimacy, divorce, deployed fathers away from the children for years on end, single mothers sent off into combat, spousal beatings, alcoholism, and suicide. All horrors for anyone who values the sanctity of the family and human life. War is glorious if you love unlimited centralized power. We have an unprecedented increase in government secrecy, including a secret court, a star chamber, where hearings are closed to the public. There are records of proceedings that are kept, but they are unavailable to the general public. Vastly expanded surveillance on American citizens, including the editors of the organization for which I work, whose only unwholesome association, as far as I could tell, is that crazy commie Ron Paul. The entirely predictable increase in militarization of law enforcement, which burnt down a church full of women and children outside of Waco, Texas, strangled a grandfather to death for the crime of selling cigarettes, which gunned down a 12-year-old boy for doing something 12-year-old boys do, play with guns. Any American citizen with the slightest spirit of constitution or just plain common sense knows this is not what freedom or normal or security looks like. War is good for a free and open society like that of the Obama Justice Department, which spied on scores of journalists, including those at the Associated Press, New York Times reporter James Risen, and also accused Fox News reporter James Rosen of criminal acts for seeking out statements from a State Department official. That used to be something called journalism in quainter times. And speaking of Barack Obama, having such a large state that ensures that someone, anyone, including and especially someone like Hillary Clinton, has the power to, as Arthur Silber put it, systematically and regularly authorize torture, order mass murder, direct the United States military to engage in one campaign of criminal conquest and genocide after another, oversee unaccountable acts of inhumanity and barbarity, and he or she will never be challenged or called into account in any manner whatsoever. He added later, by the way, there is no greater power than that of life or death. This is absolute power. This is the power claimed by every single monster in human history. The U.S. has more or less been continuously at war since the 1940s, and it was not a paradise before that, but the federal government was much smaller before the Perma War. Historian Robert Higgs has lists and lists, but this is an important one that Higgs lays out. In 1914, the federal spending totaled less than 2% of the GNP. The top rate of recently enacted federal income tax was 7% on an income over $500,000, and 99% of the population owed no income tax. There are 400,000 civilian employees, most of whom work for the post office, constituted about 1% of the labor force. The armed forces compromised few of 166,000 men on active duty, although the federal government meddled in a few areas, like of economic life, such as prescribing railroad rates, bringing antitrust suits against a handful of unlucky firms. It was for most citizens remote and unimportant. And this should be the conclusion of all of Higgs's work. Once the state expands in war, it never snaps back to its smaller size. War has certainly brought stability to Iraq. The Iraq War is one of Barack Obama's critics, William Blum, wrote, and many people in this room should read William Blum if they have not heard of him before. Beginning in 1991, Iraq was bombed for 12 years with one dubious excuse after another, then invaded, then occupied, overthrew the government, tortured without inhibition, killed wantonly. How the people of that unhappy land lost everything. Their homes, their schools, their electricity, their clean water, their environment, their neighborhoods, their mosques, their archaeology, their jobs, their careers, their professionals, their state-run enterprises, their physical health, their mental health, their health care, their welfare state, their women's rights, their religious tolerance, their safety, their security, their children, their parents, their past, their presence, their future, their lives. More than half the population either dead, wounded, traumatized, in prison, internally displaced, or in foreign exile. Their air, their soil, their water, their genes drenched with depleted uranium, the most awful birth defects, unexploded cluster bombs lying in anywhere in wait for children to pick them up, a river of blood running alongside the Euphrates and Tigris through a country that may never be put back together again.
Okay, very good. Professor Morris?
Oh, thank you. Well, thanks to everyone for inviting me here. My first Freedom Fest has been very nice so far. So, okay, war good for absolutely nothing. Ms. Keaton says yes and no, but the no parts add up to yes anyway. I also say yes and no, but in a rather different sort of way. What I mean by this, war good for absolutely nothing. I mean, war is mass murder. I mean, that's basically what it is. So unless you think mass murder is good, then obviously war is a bad thing. And yet there is more going on. And basically what I mean by that, I see myself coming here today sort of bringing three things: some bad news, some good news, and some great news. The bad news comes from the biologists, who tell us that, like all animals, we humans have evolved biologically. Like nearly all animals, we have evolved biologically to be able to use violence to settle problems between us. And then, like a few other kinds of animals, We've evolved biologically to be able to use group violence. We can organize ourselves as groups to fight and settle our problems. And that's what we normally call war. Now, what this means, the bad news, violence is always an option for humans when we've got problems to solve. If we think the costs are low enough and the benefits are high enough, violence is one way we can try to solve issues. Now, violence is biologically hardwired into us. This is the bad news. And yet also, it's kind of not. And this is where I say the good news part comes in. That unlike any other kind of animals, part of our biological evolution was the evolution of these gigantic brains we've got. Unlike any other kind of animal in the world, we can choose to change our behavior. If the costs and benefits change, we change our institutions. We can change any part of our behavior, including violence. And that is what leads me to the great news. The great news is that we have changed our use of violence. That if you had lived back in the Stone Age, you would face rates of violent death 90% more than what we face today. We are 10% as likely to die today violently as we would have done if we'd lived back in the Stone Age. That is an extraordinary thing. And I think for somebody who is against war, this should be the most important fact in the world. The fact that we have reduced rates of violent death by 90% across the last 10,000 years. There's nothing more important in the world, I would say, than finding out how did we do that? How do we carry on doing that? And so that's the good news, the bad news, the good news, and the great news. Now, this problem, it's been out there for a long time, trying to understand how these things have been working. Back in ancient Greek times, Thucydides already was thinking about this. In the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes thought a lot about this. His answer, as many of you will know, was what he called Leviathan. That basically you need something as scary as the monster Leviathan in the Book of Job, which scares people straight. He says the world is a war of all against all unless you have a Leviathan, which basically raises the costs of using violence and persuades people not to use violence because they're scared of Leviathan itself. Now, obviously, it's a little bit nervy coming into the middle of this nest of libertarians and sitting here praising the state and praising Leviathan. But I say this is the one big thing that governments do. We can argue endlessly over all the other things governments try to do, but this is what governments do, is they organize violence in order to persuade other people not to use violence. This is the big thing. Now, we now know a lot more history and so on than Thomas Hobbes did. And one of the things we know now is that humans have always fought ever since the beginning of humanity. But around the end of the last ice age, 10, 15,000 years ago, something big changed. And what changed then is that when two groups fight, if one wins, they start swallowing up the losing society to form one bigger society. The people who run these bigger societies, one of the major things they do is pacify the society they're ruling. And they do this not because they're angels. I mean, they're politicians. They're not angels. They do this because it's in their self-interest. If you are ruling a society, what you really want is all the people to get up tomorrow morning and go out and plow their fields and pay you taxes. You don't want them running around killing each other every time they have a dispute. If you don't suppress violence in your society, you are going to be pushed out by some other aristocrat or the ruler of a neighboring society or whoever it is that can suppress the violence better. Because of that, little by little, across 10,000 years, rates of violent death have fallen around the world by 90%. Now, this is the sense in which war is not good for absolutely nothing. Is that the weird effect we've had throughout 10,000 years has been that gradually war has been putting itself out of business. War creates larger and stronger governments which suppress rates of violence, and war has been putting itself out of business. Now, war, I think, clearly is the worst possible way to do this. But so far as I can tell from the history, it's pretty much the only way we've found. That's kind of the big picture. Now, obviously, not all wars contribute to this story. Easy to think of lots of examples of wars that don't contribute to creating bigger and safer societies. We even get long periods of time when pretty much no wars are contributing to pushing the world in that direction. Say, after the fall of the ancient empires, like the Roman Empire, for more than 1,000 years, wars are mostly breaking up big, safe societies to make small, violent ones, rather than the other way around. But the overall effect has been this pushing down the rates of violent death. some kinds of societies and governments are better at doing that than others as well. And in the last 200 years, we've seen a really sharp decline around the world in rates of violent death. And the biggest thing driving that, I would say, is that we've seen the growth of these governments from being leviathans, of the kind Thomas Hobbes wrote about, to being a kind of globocop, able to project power globally. Which doesn't mean anybody rules the world, but the British Empire in the 19th century to some extent, the United States more recently to a much greater extent, they've been able to create and then defend global orders of international free trade, free exchange of ideas, free movement of people, basically freedom generally. They've created and then defended these systems around the world. This has been because they've become globocops, able to project their power globally, dissuade other governments from using force to settle their problems. But, having said that, the big issue with the creation of these global systems of freedom, free trade, and this is a problem Adam Smith already saw in The Wealth of Nations, is that the invisible hand of the market can only work if it's backed up by the invisible fist of the state. You cannot have one without the other. That's the big issue. We couldn't have the kind of free world we've got without there being a globocop to protect it. This is why there's no libertarianism back in the time of Genghis Khan. Just try organizing Freedom Fest in 12th century Mongolia. Find out how well that goes. So the globocops have made the world a safer place. Now, I'm told I have 2 minutes. Or was it 1 minute? So I'm going to talk very quickly. Bring this to an end. I want to end by talking about a kind of a horror story. There's a lot more to say. I have a 400-page book on it. You can buy out there at a very reasonable price. But end with a sort of horror story. 100 years ago, the last globocop, the British, begins to break down. It's unable to deter other powers from using force. More and more governments take a risk on violence. The result is the World Wars and the Cold War. Out of the World Wars and the Cold War, we get the creation of a new global order with an American globocop. Now, I would say that the big lesson of history is that there's no peace without Leviathan, no world peace without a globocop. We have a globocop right now. We have an American globocop. And as globocops go, this is a pretty damn good globocop. The alternatives are not very attractive at all. Peace depends on preventing a rerun of the decline of the globocop that we had 100 years ago. The world cannot survive another great power, great war. So I would say, if you truly want peace, you should be doing everything you can to preserve American strength. Hence my answer to the question of war, what is it good for? Yes and no. I say absolutely nothing. Yes and no, I would say.
Very good. Angela, you have 5 minutes to respond.
Oh, well, there's so many interesting and good points, but I want to kind of cut to the few because it is a long book and there's much to discuss here. I guess war is good if you like larger organized societies, but this is like, what do you mean by good? There are those, you would argue that we must have larger centralized governments to have these better organized societies, to which I can only say why. Confiscatory taxation is a benefit. Murray Rothbard put it simply, and I really love this quote. Since production must always precede predation, the free market is anterior to the state. The state has never been created by a social contract. It has always been born in conquest and exploitation. That's the reality of the state that we're building. And I would argue that, go further, that we don't need any of that to have civilization or the Tesla that I flew or magically came up in yesterday. As for the state, and I want to, because you do discuss this in the book, and it's an important point about, empire protecting free trade. And I wake up every day in L.A., every morning, and I am surrounded by every kind of person imaginable, every race, creed, color, religion, language, you name it. And every day, these people, make exchanges with each other without police or armed guards. In fact, the only real violence in this amazing state, in this amazing city with everything there, is what the police state and the drug war brings to the city. We can do these things without armed guards. We can have free trade. In fact, I would argue the only true free trade we're going to have is without the large centralized state. And I also, too, I'm not especially a fan of anecdotes. I prefer, more straightforward empirical evidence. When we're talking about the long term of things that violence creates over time, when you're talking about those deaths, that smaller and smaller percentage of deaths, you're actually talking about live human beings. And I want to just mention, I thought about this today and just thinking in my head about drones. In The Guardian a few years ago, there's a wonderfully written essay by a father and a son, this man, writing about his mother, a midwife, who was killed by a drone. She was the town's only midwife. And in Pakistan, this is important, they do have midwives, and he was a principal of the school. And he talks about his grandchildren's reaction to this drone strike, of hearing their grandmother being killed. That is the actual experience of the statistic of the percentage of that human being, of that life that we're willing to sacrifice for this greater and bigger state. And I'm not saying that I have to sacrifice the amount of dresses I have or the choices in lipstick for that state. In fact, I would probably say that in some counterfactual, which we don't know what the answer is, we might even have more lipsticks and more dresses to choose from without this giant state. And what the definition, though, of two of the free trade you're talking about there is, I think, is more mercantilism. Ludwig von Mises, which many of you have heard about, is that when you have a large state controlling what, quote, is free trade, what you really have is mercantilism, where that empire basically stacks the deck, you know, and creates situations with other countries to where you have a society where they're the only ones, quote, getting the benefit of the free trade. You're not having truly free trade. And thank God for things like the internet and Bitcoin, to where I can have an exchange with someone. Let's say there's a woman in Afghanistan who, with cell phones, which apparently most of the world now has their cell phones, where someone in Afghanistan can trade with me via Bitcoin without any government interference whatsoever. And it's an amazing thing. I just want to add one thing, is that these mercantilist impulses are what created chaos in places like Cuba and the Philippines. And, you know, we could have had a much different world with Cuba if we had just had free trade. McDonald's makes peace everywhere.
Thanks very much, Angela. And now Professor Morris will have 5 minutes to respond as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, how can I argue with McDonald's making peace everywhere? Well, yeah, no, I'd like to thank Angela for those great comments. I mean, this is the first time I've ever done a debate in this format, as you could perhaps tell. And so, yeah, I had no idea what to expect. So this, I think, has been really interesting. But you brought up all kinds of interesting points. And one of them, I thought, was one you just mentioned. This issue of, well, how do you debate a question like this? I mean, do we debate it anecdotally, or is there some way to ground it more concretely in like actual evidence? And you know, my experience has been that people do largely talk about it anecdotally. Because I thought, did this really nice job of some anecdote, but some not anecdote stuff as well. And I mean, I think that the problem with the anecdotal approach to it, I mean, I had a really interesting experience last summer. I was part of a group invited out to Israel by the Yitzhak Rabin Center. And the idea was, you get to talk to lots of people involved in the conflict. It was while the Gaza war was going on. Talked to lots of people involved in the conflict. And one of the people we talked to was a guy named Zihad Abu Zihad, who was a negotiator for the Palestinian Authority, been involved in the peace talks, been an advisor to Yasser Arafat. And we had a series of presentations from Israeli negotiators, and they were talking about, you know, the global balance of power and how international markets were being affected by the Gaza war, and you know, all kinds of stuff. They were talking about all these different ramifications of what was going on. And this guy, Zihad Abu Zihad, he listens to them talking, saying, well, you know, that's all very impressive. You guys are much better informed about this than I am. But you are never going to win the war for international opinion, because you cannot argue with a dead baby. And whatever people on the Israeli side of negotiations ever say, we simply talk about dead babies, and you are always going to lose. And he said, you know, quite rightly, just look at the shift in international opinion toward Israel. The dead baby argument will always trump all other arguments. And I think that's right. And I think the dead baby argument is a great argument if you're only interested in winning a debate. I mean, if you think that war is a rather more serious matter than just something you win debates about, then you can't argue about it that way. But of course, the problem is, if you're getting into an empirical, methodological argument, it's rather hard to do that in an 8-minute presentation. So I will not try to take issue with everything that you said. I guess I think just one example, I think, just maybe brings up some of the differences between the ways we're looking at this. I mean, what you were just saying about Bitcoin, you know, here's something set up without state intervention. And yet, I think you could talk about lots of other things, you know, like eBay, you know, another way to put people directly in touch, make them freer to make deals and so on between them. And yet, how do you actually police what's going on and make sure that people aren't simply stealing everything? There has to be an appeal to some kind of authority. Maybe, I mean, some people think it's possible to build up coercive mechanisms to force people to play by the rules without actually having anybody threatening the use of force. Other people, like me, think that is sort of a pipe dream. And I guess I would say the same about the LA example you were talking about, that behind LA peaceful, that's maybe an overstatement, but the relatively peaceful interaction of all this huge group, very different sorts of people, there is the implied threat of Leviathan always there. And I guess I just... My reading of history is that when you look at cases where Leviathan is taken away, like the fall of the Roman Empire, the Han Dynasty in China, what you see is a great spike in rates of violence. My guess is, you know, what will happen if we take away the LAPD. It'll be like when all the power went out in New York in 1977. We get a rampage of violence. So, but again, that's not something we're likely to settle today, I guess.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you to both panelists. And now we're going to have about 10 minutes for questions. So what I'm going to do is stand at the podium, and if you have a question, raise your hand. I'll call on you. And then please come to the microphone in the middle of the room, and I will field the question from there. So I see Mark has his hand up, so he will be first.
So is this on? I hope. Yeah. So, Ian, in your book, you made a big point that war was good in World War II with Germany, that you and Japan, and that in both cases, excesses or whatever you want to call it of the dominant cultures in Japan and Germany that were very bellicose, mm-hmm. were channeled into good things. Because the U.S. won against them, and they were channeled into economic superpowers. Can that case be made to any current situation? The U.S. has tried to change created nation building. Has that worked at any other time, or is this just a unique historic event?
Yeah, well, first, thank you, Mark and Joanne, for inviting me to Freedom Fest this year. But yeah, that's a great question because, of course, if you are emphasizing that wars can have positive effects in the world, then World War II is the easy one to go to. That's like cherry-picking the examples. You know, I would love to just talk about World War II all the time. But, of course, for every World War II, you've got something like, say, the Vietnam War, which can be used as an example, or the recent occupation of Iraq, which, you know, seems to point in entirely the opposite direction. And I think often the most constructive way to think about this is to try to put things in a slightly larger perspective. I say, say World War II and World War I and the Vietnam War, I would say they make most sense bundled together as part of this like 75 years of conflict we get from 1914 through 89. In 1914, you've still got a somewhat viable global system overseen by a British Globocop, but one that is increasingly shaky on its legs. And First World War basically knocks out the British Globocop. But by the end of the Cold War, that old breaking down system has been replaced by a new global system in which we've now got an American dominated world system, and rates of violent death are falling lower than ever before. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're right to pinpoint the dangers of cherry picking examples, which can be made to show all kinds of things. And the real test, I think, comes when you put together the historical examples into these longer periods, say, you know, what is the longer term outcomes we see here? And, you know, with the 75 year war, I think you can make a pretty fair case that the world has been a better place since 1918 than it was before 1914, and that the outcome of this great struggle has had a lot to do with that result.
We'll take a question over there, and then we'll have John Utley second. So first, lady in the middle. Yes.
I have two questions. Hopefully I'll start with a better one, and then I'll get in line again. Ian, or either one of you can address this. It seems to me you're making the argument that most of history has vacillated between chaos and tyranny, and that tyranny is the better of the two. Isn't it true that the rule of law was supposed to be the next stage of evolution in that? And isn't there a difference between the rule of law as a defense against aggression and an aggressive government that attempts to control and tyrannize in order to prevent the chaos?
Do you want to say anything?
Oh, I still wanted to talk about World War II. I'm sorry.
No, fire away, by all means.
Well, you know, this is really the part, you know, and I'm a very kind of mild-mannered person, but this is the part where I start getting kind of aggressive towards you, of course. But, you know, I don't write social science fantasy fiction. I don't have any imagination at all, otherwise I would. None of us have any idea what would have happened if the U.S. had chosen not to go to war in World War II. Possibly catastrophe, possibly the mutual and must hope for destruction of Hitler and Stalin regimes, and maybe something else entirely. But a better question, this is really important because we get hit up with this question every time we have these discussions, the World War II one, which you said the cherry pick, is that here's a better question. Why is it that what actually happened, the roundup and murder of 6 million Jews, tens of millions of Russians and Poles and Germans and Japanese and others, a 500,000 American deaths, an unprecedented uprooting of our population and the hypertrophic growth of the American state and the deliverance of half of Europe to Stalin and Soviet tyranny, why is this the good war? Why is this thought to be the best possible outcome of that bloody soaked hell? And why is it some horrible breach of etiquette to ask if other paths and policies would have produced a better outcome? Shouldn't employing the largest military might on Earth, the largest military might the world has ever seen, be the last resort?
Let me ask a very quick question, sort of extending what had been asked just a minute ago from the floor. And maybe this is mostly for Professor Morris, but Angela may also want to jump in. If you do have this Leviathan, how do you restrain it? How do you transition from an aggressive state to a rule of law state? And I think Angela brought up an important point, which is even though the theory that Hobbes presents is quite clear, the idea of having a social contract in order to create a state, in practice, you know, historically states begin as aggressors. Professor Morris, do you have thoughts on how a state that begins as an aggressor can be tamed into something that is more constructive?
Interesting questions. I thought your point about history being this sort of shifting between chaos and tyranny. That's a great one-sentence summary of all of history. I think through most of human history, this is what we've seen. But then at several points, but particularly, I would say, starting in Europe in the 17th and especially the 18th century, we begin to get at least a partial move away from tyranny toward the rule of law and a different conception of the relationship between government and the people of the state. And a big part of it, I mean, I do write quite a bit about this in my book, because I think this is one of the big shifts, one of the reasons why rates of violent death have gone down so sharply in the last 200 years. I think what happens is as these systems are getting bigger and bigger, the empires the Europeans have created, the networks of trade, which initially, as you were saying, mercantilist networks of trade, as they're getting bigger and bigger, people begin to see that the balance has shifted. Like, say, in the 17th century, European powers, on the whole, what they're interested in is killing other European powers. This is all they want to do. France wants to fight Spain. Spain wants to fight England. That's all they want to do. And the rest of the world is of interest because this is a place to raise money to pay for your wars at home. And then in the 18th century, though, some people start to notice, well, wait a minute. The revenue coming in from our overseas trade is so much bigger than the revenue we would get if we actually could kill all the Spanish. So why are we using the rest of the world to pay for wars in Europe? Why not, this is particularly in Britain, people notice this first, why not look at trade with the rest of the world as the goal, the end rather than the means, and look at the wars in Europe as a means to get to that end. We fight wars in Europe in order to tie up the other European powers so that we can go around establishing trade networks all over the world. We make sure France never gets to dominate Europe so that we can dominate global trade. And this is the insight that begins to come up in the 18th century. Then Adam Smith is the guy who clarifies the whole thing and say, it's not about taxing anybody, it's not about plundering anybody. If you just create networks of global trade and engage in them, you will make so much more money than you're ever going to make by having a formal empire and ruling anyone. And that, I say, that's the point when people start saying that the benefits from tyranny and violent government are declining sharply. We are all going to be better off if we create a more open, more market-based society. We have to still have state power in order to make that work. But increasingly, I think in the 18th, 19th, especially the 20th centuries, some governments start saying the way to go is to liberalize, to open up, and to engage in free markets. And obviously you can argue, but on the whole, the further a country moves in that direction, the happier its experience has been.
Angel, any response to that?
I absolutely agree with markets and free trade. You know, you're not going to get any argument from me there. I think though we have a definite disagreement though over ultimately because it's the Leviathan is what we disagree on. I want less force and violence, and to me that Leviathan is the source of the violence. I mean, I understand the point you're making about LAPD, but my experience in LA is. I was driving yesterday in LA, and for those of you who know, I'm a New Yorker, so driving is always a scary proposition anyway. But I made eye contact, unfortunately, with an LAPD officer, and I made a different turn because I was that frightened about being pulled over. And I don't think I'm being hysterical or weird or paranoid. I mean, just the experience of living in a large city with a very strong police force that can't be unquestioned, to me, is not how I want to live. And it's not even any different in Keene, New Hampshire. I mean, police, cops are not friendly people.
Keene?
No, it's a kind of an inside joke. We have a small, our people have a libertarian enclave. They're trying to take over parts of New Hampshire. I shouldn't tell you that part.
My wife is from Keene.
Oh, okay.
Her mother still lives there.
Oh, really? Okay.
I don't think she's taken over anything.
No.
We have about 2 minutes left, so I'll let John have the last question here.
Thank you, Dan. It's very interesting, the question that many people died of violence in past history. I'd read in tribal warfare, a third of the populations died from violence. So that's a very good point, except the story's not over yet, namely these nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And I live in Washington. And it's amazing how casual the talk shows are, and the particularly intellectuals and the think tanks, about starting another war. And it's always the attitude, we can go bomb anywhere and kill anywhere. It'll never come to us. And we're now spending tens of billions to refurbish our nuclear bombs. It's more like a jobs program, actually, because it is in key congressional districts and produces jobs. There's very little counter argument against it. So, and I'm a bit unusual. I was in, when I was 18 in Germany, I went through East Berlin on a bus tour. The whole city of East Berlin was flat as far as the eye could see. So it's something I visualized. We are very casual on this nuclear war. Historically, don't people eventually use these weapons? And it's very, as I say, it's so casual. Well, let's go bomb Iran. There's no thought where war leads to. Sun Tzu had said the greatest generals win without starting a war because you never know where a war leads.
Great. Thanks, John. Yeah. Let's have a very quick response, about 45 seconds from each person, if you have something to comment on that question. Nuclear weapons, how do they change the picture?
Yeah, well, just very quickly. I mean, one of the big arguments nuclear strategists often make is that nuclear weapons change everything because they're the weapon you can't use. And because of that, some people think they've been one of the biggest causes of world peace, paradoxically, since World War II, because it's the cost of going to war if the other side's got nuclear weapons, or even if you have yourself. I mean, oh my God, it's unthinkable. And yet here we are in Vegas, it's like you're gambling, you're raising the stakes, and you're hoping everybody understands what you're doing. One mistake and it's over. But yeah, it's a truly terrifying development.
Nukes seem to be the cause of a lot of bad ideas, including one I didn't realize, that there was once an attempt to let's make ourselves a bigger Panama Canal by nuking it and making it bigger. And the second point I just want people to remember, we could have still had cell phones without the bombing of Dresden.
Okay, so we're going to move on to closing statements now of 3 minutes each. First we will have Professor Morris, and then Angela will have the last word.
Okay, well, thank you. To wrap up then, I guess what I was saying is because of the animals that we are, violence is part of us, violence is a central problem in social order. And we may not like it, but history shows that the solution to this problem of violence has been government. And governments created, indirectly by wars, governments have suppressed violence. Rates of violent death around the world have come down by 90% since the Stone Age. But, of course, governments are created by violence. And that's why my answer to the question was sort of complicated. War, I think, has been slowly putting itself out of business. It's an exaggeration to say that war is good for absolutely nothing. It is good, I think, for has been good for one thing in the past. And well, we were talking about anecdotes earlier. I want to close anecdotally. There's, as many of you, I'm sure, will know, Ronald Reagan, in a speech he gave in 1988, said that the 10 scariest words in the English language are, "Hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Seems to me he was mistaken on that. The 10 scariest words are really, "There is no government and I'm here to kill you." Those are the 10 scariest words. And I think Ronald Reagan actually would have largely agreed with me on this. Another speech he gave back in 1973, he said, I wrote this one down to make sure I quote it properly. He says, "One legislator accused me of having a 19th century attitude on law and order. That is a totally false charge. I have an 18th century attitude. The founding fathers made it clear that the safety of law-abiding citizens should be one of the government's primary concerns." And I think he was almost right there. If only he'd gone the final step and had a 17th century attitude, then it would have been absolutely right. More the sort of attitude that Hobbes had, making it very clear what the source of law and order were, what it is that basically saves us from our biology. And that's why I was saying the greatest force for peace is American strength. If you're against war, make sure the United States stays strong.
Okay, so Angela, you will have the last word here.
Okay. You know, we don't know alternative outcomes if we didn't go to war in situations. It's indisputable that the U.S. entry into World War II brought the U.S. itself to the brink of outright central planning during the war. And we have a highly regulated, highly taxed security state to show for it. Political scientist Bruce Porter studied the Western world for six centuries and found, and I love this quote, "A government at war is a juggernaut of centralization determined to crush any internal opposition that impedes the mobilization of militarily vital resources. The central tendency of wars has made the rise of the state throughout history a disaster for liberty," and he writes, "that this history does not horrify most people signifies that only the majority of humanity has yet to grasp the sacred, irreplaceable value of a single human life." You know, the cause of big government in the United States, however, war seldom receives its due. And even if I could falsify all of Professor Morris's premises and were to concede every empirical point, there's still one principle that those of us who hold dear. And this is really important because I think of the perspective that most of us are coming from. Only individuals exist, not collective statistics of human being throughout human history. And while it's fashionable among the left and liberals to mock and vilify Ayn Rand, her concept of the individual is something real and something vital, and is a step to not only morally righteous, but it's a step towards a consequential step toward peace. Recognizing individual human dignity makes bombing and torturing people more difficult. It would make for respect and friendship for all. Civilized humans engage in consensual, voluntary capitalist acts every day, free and voluntary trade. People can exchange goods and services for lands and resources, and that's what normal should look like. Some people call it free market, you know, the American way, the American dream. Either way, bombing one's way to peace and prosperity is not only impossible, it's just morally unjust. Thank you.
Well, I would like to thank Professor Morris and Angela Keaton. I think Mark may have a quick statement here.
I just want to recommend this book, War, What It Is Good For. I've read this book cover to cover by Ian Morris, and he stole your title, Angela. You should have used this title, but this book is really fantastic. So we're doing an autograph session right after. Where'd Michael go? Oh, right here? Yeah, at the bookstore, and Ian, you're going to be over there to autograph the book, right? Highly recommended.
Okay. Well, as we wrap up here, let's take a quick survey of the audience, hands up or hands down. Who agrees, now that you've heard both panelists, that war is good for absolutely nothing?
Say it again.
So it looks like the audience still tilts in Angela's direction, but I think Professor Morris may have cut down the numbers a little bit. And we'll do one last question here. Who had their thinking about war changed in some way by this panel? Okay, pretty respectable numbers. So thanks again.